to Shattering Mist. It's my pleasure now to be able to turn the page. We're going to consider Yahweh's testimony regarding his creation account. We are now at the end of the second day. Here's God's testimony in this regard. God, which is Elohim, called, Kara, proclaimed, summoned, invited, and endowed matter and space, the abode of the stars. So God called this this Raka, the firmament, the expanse, the abode of the stars, Shamayim, heaven. It was now the end of the day and the beginning of the day, Arab, which means evening, night, darkness, a mixing together of an interwoven fabric of time, and the beginning of the day, Bokor. Morning or sunrise from Bakar, meaning to seek, to search, to inquire, to consider, and to reflect. All of this existed as the second day. Scientifically, our solar system was created during this period. It happened in the manner that God has just testified. Water was present and water was essential. There was an association between all things because relativity and time are linked. And separation, the repulsive nature of dark energy, still lies at the heart of the efforts that we can observe. Now, if you recall, God's presentation of this time was incredibly sophisticated. And I think so because there is no more difficult period to report on than what happened in this second creative epoch. It was fairly straightforward in terms of the transformation of God's word and his energy into light, and this transformation of energy into matter that became the essence of the first day following the Big Bang, or of day one to be more precise. But here, this is about this ongoing formation of the universe as we know it. And so God's statement in this regard was, God prepared and produced accordingly matter and space, dividing and separating relative things in space over an interval of time. From the waters, relative to and pertaining to that which is interchanged concerning matter and space by means of an interval of time for encouraging understanding, relative to the proximity of the waters, and matter and space existed, therefore, verifiable and correct. This was not a creative day in the sense of on day one, God spoke and he created the universe through a Big Bang, using his terminology. In day two, the effect of the calculation that he had made, the effect of what he had done on day one, led to what happened in the second cosmological era. So God is simply reporting what transpired. Day one was about creation. Day two was the result of what he had set in motion. And so much of Scripture is that way, where God will make a statement, will create, for example, the covenant with Abraham, and then much of what he says thereafter simply reports on what he has set in motion. He doesn't modify the covenant. He doesn't annul the covenant. He doesn't replace the covenant. He simply tells you the ongoing effect of people's interaction with his covenant and the ongoing story of the covenant. And so that is really what we're witnessing in day two, although there is a decided emphasis here on telling us that everything is relative. Your position relative to God is what really matters. If your position relative to God is to be with him, set apart from this world that he created, to him, then you are in a relationship with him. Again, that's a relative concept. And that if you are instead reliant on religion or politics or patriotism and aligned with these things, if that is your perspective, if that is your relative position, then relative to the covenant, relative to God, you are estranged from him. And so this is the expansion, this great divide that was taking place at this time. And this enormous difference between the spiritual realm and the material realm. We today are part of the material realm. All things in the material realm have a finite existence. And so to transition to an infinite existence, to be empowered, because that which is matter is hugely less empowered than that which is energy, because while matter is organized energy, it is a diminished form of energy. And so do we want to stay in this relatively unempowered position? Do we want to stay in this position where all things devolve and are finite? Is that relative position that which we want to embrace? Or do we want relationally to be with the light, to be spiritual, to be infinite, to choose to be with God? And then God goes on to incorporate in that discussion on the second day of the importance of water. Because water is not only the source of life, the place from which life emerges. We are mostly water even in our physical bodies. You know, I just this past week received the remains of my father-in-law. And he was originally buried, but as we wanted to relocate him so that he would be with my mother-in-law in burial, he was previously buried on my farm in the East Coast, and the sarcophagus leaked. Now my guess is that virtually every sarcophagus that is put in the ground leaks, and that most people just don't have a reason to relocate someone, so they just don't know. Well, when it leaks, of course, it fills with water, and now the coffin, which is also supposed to be watertight, also filled with water. And so rather than bring him forward in his coffin, which was not possible now because of the water damage, we elected to have my father-in-law cremated. And so he was he arrived here a few days ago, and he's in a container that's it's a rectangular container. It's about 5 inches by 4 inches by about 8 inches. And because that is the sum total of the substance of him that was not water. In the cremation process, the water went away. We are mostly water. And in this world, and what God is telling us is that we need a spiritual rebirth for us to be in a relationship with him. And also, water is the universal solvent. It's the most effective solvent. And so water is also extraordinary. So that parlays into God's teaching about how through his Torah guidance, he cleanses us. And then you go to the uniqueness of water, that it is the only substance that when it becomes cooler actually expands. And God is unique. The covenant relationship is unique. God is one. There's only one real God. He is different than anything else. And of course, as we talked yesterday, one of the best ways to understand Yahweh as our Heavenly Father and the fact that he has two representatives, two aspects of his nature set apart from him to serve us, is again water, where you can take two buckets of water from a large source and freeze one and boil the other, and you have two manifestations of that water that have different functions, and yet they're comprised of exactly the same thing, and they return to the same thing. They're diminished manifestations set apart from your large source of water. And yet in the different forms as ice and steam, they remain water. Identical. And it's so water has so many underlying characteristics that aid in our understanding, which is why God focused on it. But also, spiritually, Two, this is the second day. Two is the number of choice, which is, again, relative to our relationship. Do we want to be in a position where we are with God? Do we choose that? Or do we choose the position that we are with man? So the second day is focused on this separation, this choice. We need to decide whose side we want to be on. The side of light or the side of darkness? Are we going to remain mired in the realm of matter and space? Are we going to relate to our Creator in such a way that we exist eternally in time with Him as light? Likewise, from the perspective of our redemption, the second day is linked to the second Moed Mikre, of the invitation to be called out and meet with God, known as matzah, or unleavened bread. Its purpose is to remove, to separate yeast, which is symbolic of sin, particularly religious and political sin, from bread, which represents our natural bodies, our mortal souls. It is this separation which makes us acceptable to God. The fungus has been removed from us so that it is possible for us to be in His presence. Historically, the second millennium of human history, consistent with Yahweh's creative witness, is punctuated with the ultimate story of water separating mankind from life and from God. Noah was called out and separated from the midst of evil men, living in a wooden ark of protection designed by God while the waters rose and consumed those who chose the wrong side of the divide. It is interesting, too, that even the Hebrew word for ark means enlightened free will, choice. If you want to live with God, you'll have to trust Him. You will have to embrace the Ark of the Covenant. You'll have to align yourself with the Ark of the Covenant. And in that regard, God's Ark of the Covenant was also built of wood, not unlike the upright pole upon which He hung on Passover. These are all symbolic symbols which help us understand what God is offering, who He is, and enable us to make an informed choice. It is about choosing to be set apart unto Yahweh. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Speaking of the future history of humankind, it is interesting to note that we know for certain that a flood of massive proportions occurred 5,000 years ago, approximately 3,000 BCE. Now, this is interesting because it occurred in the region where men created in God's image, with a nesalma conscience, in addition to a nefesh soul or consciousness, lived. Yahweh told us that Eden was at the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which is near the Black Sea. If you're looking for the exact location, I think it is under Lake Van in eastern Turkey. There are five rivers that are described. If you examine the headwaters, as we will, because we're going to spend a number of shows, probably a month of programming, on Noah. That we will, even before Noah, we're going to spend a series of programmings also on the garden and what transpired there. The location of it is given to us very precisely. And so it is very near the where we would find Lake Van today. And so that's where the first humans with a nesalma, who had a conscience in addition to a nefesh soul, emerged. And they intermarried with the Homo sapiens without a nesalma that lived outside of the garden. And Yahweh told us that that as a result of this, that there were a number of civilizations that were formed initially east and south of the garden, including Babylon, Assyria, and Sumer. Archaeologists, of course, have found cities 200 feet below the current shores of the Black Sea as well. And a 12-foot thick layer of silt and mud was laid down all at once in Mesopotamia, precisely when the oldest scriptural text said the flood occurred. So, if you'll keep listening, you'll discover in a chapter devoted entirely to the event that we even have evidence from what's called now the Burkle Crater, that it hit the earth, causing this massive flooding of Mesopotamia all the way up to the Black Sea, precisely when Yahweh said that the flood occurred, which was on the second day, which again is why there is so much emphasis on water. Now, as evidence for the obvious, consider Bereshith, Genesis 7:22. It speaks of the aftermath and the purpose of the flood. But be forewarned, to appreciate Yahweh's insights in this regard, one has to correctly communicate what God actually revealed. English translations, unfortunately, add three words which are not in the text, and they ignore three words which are actually there. When they inaccurately communicate or translate the meaning of the following message. This is Bereshith 7:22. All who had within their breath and nature, their aptitude and attitude at their disposition, the nesalma of life, the nesalma chaya, all with the spirit ruach of desolation from cherub, that which dries up, lays waste, and destroys, died. The nesalma that is part of human nature and enables us to connect spirit to soul, to know right from wrong, good from bad, truth from deception, God from the adversary, is the essential element here. There were Homo sapiens around the globe by this time, but only a small proportion of them, those from the Black Sea down to the mouth of the Tigris-Euphrates rivers, had the nesalma. That is why civilization began here. That's why recorded history began here. These Homo sapiens with the nesalma, ability to exercise good judgment, were vastly superior in their thinking capability, and thus that's just where societies were formed. But the nesalma is also capable of plotting and conceiving all sorts of evil. And just as it is the gift of God that enables us to choose Him, it is also gives others the ability to ally themselves with the spirit of desolation, the spirit of lifelessness, which is HaSatan and his fallen messengers. And it was those that Yah wiped out. He didn't wipe out all of humanity. He wiped out those with a nesalma that had embraced the spirit of lifelessness. And he did so for a reason. If they had been allowed to continue, there would have been no opportunity to share his covenant, his Torah, through the children of Yisrael. We would have destroyed ourselves before them. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. The nesalma, which is the operative term of the passage we just considered, which were those who were the target of the flood. God realized that the marriage between HaSatan, the adversary, and humankind with this gift of the nesalma had become so destructive, so lifeless, so debilitating, that these civilizations, which were amongst the worst in human history, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, that they would ultimately have made it impossible for human history to evolve over 6,000 years, for God to be able to reveal His message through the covenant with Abraham and through the children of Israel to the world, because they would have been so murderous, so destructive. And so to enable his timeline to play out, to enable him to be able to share his testimony with us and to develop his covenant relationship with us for our benefit, Yahweh ended the threat of early demise and lifelessness that these people posed. And he destroyed them. It is very similar to what would have happened had God chosen to identify the 10,000 people most responsible for Nazism in Germany and to have eliminated them to spare the lives of some 50 million people that died in a war that those aligned with the dark spirit of the adversary perpetrated on humankind. The reason God did not intervene then is he really is opposed to usurping free will. That he recognized that because that was a war in Europe and that he had long since revealed his testimony, and that his promises to Israel would actually be facilitated by the carnage of that war, he allowed them to be destructive. But when it came to the first people that benefited from the Nesama and turned that benefit into an ugly tool in association with Satan, God did not have the opportunity to say, you know, I'm just going to let this run its course, because he recognized that they would have been too destructive and too deadly. It's again like Yah's instructions to the children of Israel when they returned to the promised land after the 400 years in slavery in Egypt. The iniquity of those who were now occupying some dozen towns in the promised land had reached the point where if they were not removed as the host of the of these hideous religious and political schemes that were so obnoxious, so grotesquely immoral, that there is no way that Yahweh could have the children of Israel be a set-apart community, a family unto him, for the express purpose of exposing the benefits and the detriments associated with either embracing or rejecting the covenant. So don't expect God to intervene on a regular basis. But on the second day he did, and water was his tool, which is why the creation account is written as it is. So the Nesama is that part of human nature that enables us to connect spirit to soul, to know right from wrong, good from bad. It serves as our conscience. It is passed down through Adam. Therefore, the only people Yahweh was interested in eliminating were those within the Nesama who had chosen to associate with the spirit of desolation, of lifelessness. Also, so that you are not misled, the word translated earth in reference to the flood in most Bibles actually means land, ground, region, or realm. When the account of Noah and the ark is translated to infer that every animal on the planet was aboard and that all Homo sapiens drown, with exception of those eight, and that the whole earth was submerged to the top of the highest mountains, the translators are errantly conveying Yahweh's message and making a mockery of his witness. There wasn't even remotely enough water on earth, even on or above our planet, to reach the summit of mountains like Everest. But there was more than enough water to accomplish exactly what Yahweh wanted and what he attested to. And while we're on the subject of the deluge, if you were to rely on English translations of the pagan term called the Bible, prepared in 1384 CE through 1975, or the Masoretic, prepared 1000 CE through 1550 CE, you'd have to time the flood to 2348 BCE a date which is inconsistent with geology, archaeology, and written history. The Septuagint, which was prepared 300 to 200 BCE, adds exactly 100 years to six generations between Shem and Abraham, and 20 years to a seventh, something confirmed by the Sumerian Pentateuch, which was prepared 400 to 600 BCE in each case. This would place the flood very near 2968 BCE. Now, the reason for these textual discrepancies is actually quite simple. Paleo-Hebrew used a horizontal line above an alpha numerical representation to convey the 100th place numerically. Papyrus was woven such that the fibers formed horizontal ridges and indentations. When the ink and writing implements of the day, which were fairly crude, were used, with consistent unfurling of scrolls, horizontal lines became virtually invisible in all but the best light and best conditions. So the scribes simply left out the 100th place in these six post-flood and pre-Arabian generations because they could no longer be seen. All right, now that our solar system has been formed, and our planet has some time to cool, we're about to commence on the third day. The Earth was ready for the gathering of liquid water into oceans, the cradle of life. Using the formula we have been given, we can safely conclude that the third cosmological day dawned sometime around 3.8 billion years ago. This corresponds to the time the fossil record tells us that plants initially flourished on our planet and in its emerging seas. Now, God's testimony remains consistent with the evidence at our disposal. Here's how it reads. The Almighty said, "Let the waters, by way of separation in an orderly sequence of exchanging one thing for another, under the abode of the stars, lay in wait, collected and bound together into one place, and let the Yabasha appear." Now, Yabasha is a word we will consider later. I'm just going to transliterate it for now. Appears from Ra'ah, be seen. And it existed correct and verifiable, Haya. And God called the Yabasha land, and the gathering and binding together of the waters he called seas. And God saw and considered that it was good, Tob, pleasant and agreeable, excellent and valuable, prosperous and beneficial. Now on the surface, this happened to be Bereshit 1, 9, and 10. This is an adroit declaration of what occurred on planet Earth at this time. Our world cooled to below the boiling point as volcanic activity began to wane. More translucent atmosphere started to form as a result of diminished plumes of volcanic ash and as a consequence of a radically diminished asteroid bombardment. And the reason that there was so much less asteroid bombardment is that the Earth and Moon, as well as the other planets and the Sun, cleaned out so much of the debris left from the formation of our solar system, particularly that which had an intersecting orbit with the Earth. You know, that those that the debris that intersected with the Earth hit the Earth, and only those that were nudged out of their path were left to potentially impact the Earth at a later time. And so the tectonic plate movements began to reach a position whereby there were fewer volcanoes. The Earth's surface hardened to the point there were fewer volcanoes. This had a huge effect because there is no larger source of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, smoke and ash, making it so that it cannot, the light cannot filter down to the Earth, which is also essential for life. And so this all occurred at this time. And so the liquid water cooled below the boiling point, and the sun's light began, even though it wasn't the atmosphere wasn't transparent, at least it was translucent enough that the water was able to flow into the seas, and the seas were warmed, therefore they were not, didn't go from boiling to ice. They were warmed enough by this greenhouse effect that there was the immediate expectation of life. The conditions existed where life was possible. What's interesting here is that once again, nothing was created on this day. One thing simply flowed from another. The sequence Yahweh laid out was substantive, orderly, and rational. His words continue to sound more like a scientific textbook than religious musings of primitive humans. So God isn't, the statement here, he doesn't say, you know, I created the seas on this time. He just, these last 2 days, he has said that as a result of this equation that he calculated that transformed energy into to matter over a prolonged period of time, that it led to this place. Again, it's very much like the covenant. The covenant was created once. And the ongoing benefits of what it leads to and growth and development are a result of the one calculation of the covenant, the one creation of the covenant. And so this is the way that the universe evolved from the position of the Big Bang. You know, God is speaking not of the evolution of life, but of the evolution of the universe from the Big Bang. All saying that this was the result of his calculation. So his words reinforce precisely what we observe when we carefully examine this galactic spaceship in which we live. We'll return to this story with Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Shattering Myths. If you were to be superficial in your reading of this declaration, there is a about what occurred on our planet Earth at this time, you just realize that our world cooled to below the boiling point, and therefore there was the opportunity for water to gather into the seas, leaving the land dry. And so we're going to investigate here the meaning of Yevesha so that we understand this distinction that God is making, because he's clearly setting the waters apart as the source of life, and the Yevesha is then therefore the comparison, which would be that which is still desolate or lifeless. The material realm, again, being lifeless. Spiritually, the first half of the third day is devoted to gathering the beneficial and uniting natures of the waters while separating the Yevesha. Now, while Mayim is clearly water, Yevesha might be a bit of mystery if it wasn't defined by God. Now, it is usually translated dry land, even though there is no reference to land, dirt, soil, ground, or earth in the word. The term is feminine, and it is used in Yeshayahu, which is Isaiah 44:3, to depict the material, the maternal, set-apart spirit being poured out upon the spiritually parched descendants of Jacob. So here we see the descendants of Jacob who have not embraced the covenant, having the opportunity to be included because of the maternal set-apart spirit being poured out spiritually upon them, providing them with life. And this is being done at some future date, this date where the descendants of Jacob have the set-apart spirit poured out upon them as the Day of Reconciliations. That'll be October 2nd at sundown in 2033. So let's turn to that passage to see if Yeshayah, Isaiah, can unravel the Yevesha mystery for us. The prophetic chapter opens with a creative flashback. It says, now listen, Jacob, my servant, and Yisrael, whom I have chosen. Thus says Yahweh, who made you and created you from the womb, and will help you. Do not fear, for I will pour out Yachak. I will wash and grant favors using water upon the thirsty, flowing forth upon the parched. I will pour out my spirit, my ruach, upon your offspring, my blessing, my baraka, my gift to you upon your descendants. So the flowing forth upon the parched is yabasha. So it is those who are lacking the spirit and were thus desolate have that problem resolved. They are reconciled. They are renewed. They are now a form of eternal life. They benefit from all of this by the pouring out of Yahweh's Ruach spirit upon the Yabasha. So here clearly, Yabasha does not mean dry land. It means those who were formerly lifeless are now nourished by a source of living waters that brought by the set-apart spirit. Again, with water fulfilling the concept of being a source of life and being a source of cleansing, both of which are aspects, are responsibilities of the set-apart spirit. So in this case, Yabasha defines souls who were, prior to the application of the spirit, bereft of Yahweh's spirit, his life-giving and nurturing spirit, which is akin to his gift of living waters. The passage has nothing to do with ground, dry or otherwise. Now, if we search the root of Yabasha, we discover that Yabesh means withered and dried up. In other words, desolate or lifeless. In Midbar, wilderness, in the wilderness, Numbers 11:6, Yabesh is used for in connection with the nefesh, which is a soul, to indicate that the soul is forsaken, and therefore it is desolate of life. This, from a spiritual perspective, we can safely conclude now that Yahweh selected Yabasha at the outset of his accounting of what occurred on creation's third day to convey that without his spiritual source of life and cleansing, both of which are associated with water, without his gift of living waters, our souls remained parched. We'll return to this story tomorrow.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects of